Hayim Divrei Hanes. State, there is a rule, there is a musag in halacha, it's a mitzvah to fulfill the words of someone in a tzava. Now, this is not only because of kibud aviyim. If it's a parent, you have kibud aviyim, but even without kibud aviyim, let's assume that one is yarshining, if a husband yarshins from his wife, there's a mitzvah l'kayim divrei hanes. If a brother yarshins from a brother, mitzvah l'kayim divrei hanes. So l'chara, one might assume, all right, a will is not effective to give the daughter ownership. The will is not effective to give the wife ownership. But the Yorshim are mechuyev al pi din to fulfill the tzava based on the principle of mitzvah l'kayim divrei hanes. But the emes is, in halacha, mitzvah l'kayim divrei hanes is by and large not a mechanism to make a will halachically enforceable. And let me explain why that is so for two reasons. First, we have the Shita of Rabbeinu Tam in Taisus and Gittin, and the Shulchan Aruch Paskin by Rabbeinu Tam, that the mitzvah l'kayim divrei hanes is not triggered by a mere verbal or even written instruction, but it only applies when an escrow has been established. Meaning to say, if when the decedent was alive, he transferred property or money to a third party with an instruction that upon his death, that money should go to a certain person, that is when you have the idea of mitzvah l'chaim divrei hanes. This is called kushlash mitchila l'cha. Now that might work in things like a trust, where you establish a trust, you put it in the bank with instructions that upon your death it should go. That might be a mitzvah l'chaim divrei hanes taka. But if it's stama will, where the property is in your name and a person dies, just because you instructed that it should go, mitzvah l'chaim divrei hanes, but you don't have the requisite escrow, and because you don't have the requisite escrow, it's not hushlish mitchila l'chach, zakt l'beinu tam, we do not say the principle of mitzvah l'chaim divrei hanes. We might have said kibud aviyein, like Rabbi Kiveger tells us, on Yerusha, there's no din of kibud aviyein either, because it becomes shel av, and not, I'm sorry, it becomes shel ben, and not shel av. A second reason why mitzvah l'chaim divrei hanes doesn't work in some cases is, let's assume that the yoresh, the son, who's the yoresh, is a katan. So the Rishonim already speak out, since mitzvah l'kayim divrei hanes is based on the chiyuv of obeying the mitzvah of l'kayim divrei hanes, a katan is not mechuyev in mitzvahs. If a katan is not mechuyev in mitzvahs, there's no way al pi din that on a katan there's a mitzvah l'kayim divrei hanes. And therefore, at least in some of those cases, mitzvah l'kayim divrei hanes cannot bind a katan because katanim are lav b'nei mitzvah ninu. So again, in terms of our review, we have this Seder Yerusha. We have the general rule of Masna, Mashakasa Batara Tunai Bakal. We have the secondary problem of Ein Ruach HaChamim Neicha Himena, which is Avuriach Santa. We talked about Kibud Aviyim not working as a Mechayev, and Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hanes not working as a Mechayev. Let's now go to a third possibility which might make a will valid from the perspective of halacha, and this was your point, and that is the principle of dina, the malchusa dina. This is a statement that the Amora Shmuel says in a number of places in the Gemara, that says that Bavakama, Nidorim, and Gittin, that the law of the government is halachically binding on Jews, dina, the malchusa dina, and this is stated in particular regarding taxes. If a Jew evades taxes, again, it's important for Jews to be aware, not only is it a violation of the Internal Revenue Code, which is serious enough, but even more importantly, from a spiritual perspective, it is a violation of halacha. We are mechuyev to obey the law of the Malchus, and if we fail to obey the law of the Malchus, we are considered to be violating the religious law of the Torah. Interestingly enough, this little aphorism, Dina de Malchus Adina, there is no mucker in Chazal for it. In other words, what's the mucker? Why is it Dina de Malchusa Dina? And there are different makoros that are suggested in the Rishonim. Some Rishonim trace Dina de Malchusa Dina to the verse in Yirmiyahu, the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, where when the Yidden were put into Galus, and many of them were very despondent, they were commanded, Dirshu Shalom Hoir, seek out the welfare of the society in which you find yourselves, build houses, construct vineyards, etc., because in its peace you will find peace. In fact, that is the marker clearly for the idea of being mispalel, the shlomo shel malchus, for praying for the government. So some Rishonim say this is actually the makor of Dina D'machlus Adina, Dirshu Shalom Oir, the fact that a Jew should seek the welfare of the society that they are in. Rashi and Gittin says a different makor. Rashi and Gittin says a very, very interesting makor. Rashi says that the makor of Dina D'machlus Adina is from one of the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach. The seventh Noachite commandment is to establish a court system and a system of law. Now, see the Chiddush of Rashi. Most of us would learn, oh, well, that's an obligation that Goyim have towards Goyim. But Rashi says, no, implicit, it's a big extension, implicit in the Noachide legitimation of law and courts is that Jews, too, are bound by the Noachide system. This is the makar of Dina D'Malchus Adina. The question becomes, of course, is Dina D'Malchus Adina a relevant concept that will enable the legitimation of wills, which under secular law deviate from the Seder of Yerusha, even if it's Matzah Masha Kasef Atayim. So, of course, as you would expect, this is a fundamentally totally on how do you understand Dina D'Malchus Adina. And to understand that Machlekes Rishonim here, I have to quote the Gemara in Gittin at some length. The Mishnah says in Gittin the following rule. Kol hashtaras ha'olim be'arkos shalakum. Legal documents that have been validated in a non-Jewish court. A deed. Afal pi shechosmeyam ha'vikachavim. Even if the witnesses are goyim that are totally pasul li'edus, these are valid transactions. Now the Gemara asks the kasha like this. The Gemara Gittin asks, well, we know, except for a get. Get, you know, things about marriage and divorce, obviously, it's not valid. Now we know that there are two types of shtaros in halacha. There is a shtar that is only a shtar raya. For example, if I lend you $100 and we have a document that says you borrowed money, the shtar doesn't create the obligation. The shtar is just evidence of an obligation. There's another type of shtar, however, where the document itself effects the transfer of ownership. For example, if I give you a field as a gift and I write out a deed, the shtar is not just evidence that I gave you the field. The shtar is the vehicle by which the kinyan takes place. It's a shtar kinyan. So the Gemara asks the following kasha. Bishlama, where the shtar is simply a proof that a transaction occurred, I understand how the chachamim could legitimate non-Jewish signatures, because if it's only a matter of evidence, they could say that anything that has the stamp of the court, presumably witnesses are afraid to lie, judges, again, depending on the court system, but the Chazal had the assumption that a court system was honest enough that if it was certified, you could assume that the transaction happened. In other words, you don't need witnesses, you just need evidence that a transaction happened. However, the Gemara says, where the shtar effects the transaction, and in order for a shtar to be kosher, you have to have edus. The most reliable guy is not a kosher aid. How could it be good? So the Gemara gives two answers. Answer number one is, the shtar could be legitimated because of Dina D'Malchusa Dina. If it's valid under secular law, it'll be valid under halacha. And the second answer is, yeah, you're right, the Mishnah is only legitimating shtar raya, it's not legitimating shtar kinyan. Now, the machlokas is, do we paskin like answer one, or we paskin like answer two? Many Rishonim say, we paskin only like answer two, meaning that Dina D'Malchus Adina does not apply to the legitimation of a shtar kinyan. And the reason is, the Rashba says the following. Dina D'Malchus Adina only applies in matters in which the government has a direct benefit. It applies to tax collection, which of course are revenues. It applies to currency restrictions. It applies to general laws which promote the public welfare, such as speeding limits, occupational and safety rules, minimum wages. But the Ramban and the Rashba say, on any inyanim, which are simply bein adam l'chaveira, between me and you, as individual Jews, those Rishonim say, Dina D'Malchus Adina does not apply, and relationships between Jews have to be governed exclusively by Din Torah, and that is why, if I sell you a field and I give you a legal document that was prepared under non-Jewish auspices, the Gemara's second teretz is it's not going to be valid al Dina D'Malchus Adina, because that is not something that has a tayelas hamelech, that is simply bein adam l'chaveira. That is how some Rishonim learn. Other Rishayim do in fact paskin, like the first answer, that allows in monetary matters, of course, only in monetary matters, dinu d'machus adina to apply, even if it's bein adam l'chaveiro, and the government does not have a direct interest. Again, tracing the halacha in the Shulchan Aruch is quite a complicated thing, because the Shulchan Aruch incorporates different tshuvas in different places, different rishonim in different places. But this yesod of the Rashba is fairly well makubal in halacha, that dina de malchus adina only applies on matters in which the government has a direct interest. It does not apply in the ordering of private affairs. This is actually very relevant in another issue, which I'll just allude to, the halachic permissibility of bankruptcy. You know, I teach bankruptcy, so I'm a little familiar with it from a secular perspective. And that is, you know, when a person files bankruptcy, the most outstanding thing that happens at the end of the road is all of his debts get wiped out. Not all of his debts, but a lot of his debts get wiped out. Now the question is, if I owe money to my Jewish creditors, again, vis-a-vis Goyim, it's a devar pashut, dina de malchusa works. That's not a question. I mean, that's the law of the government. You're not allowed to cheat a Goyim, that's for sure. That's Geneva Stas and everything else, but you're allowed to utilize civil law. But we're asking, vis-a-vis another Yid, am I allowed to stiffen by filing a bankruptcy petition? The question becomes, do I say dina de malchusa dina on bankruptcy? So once again, it would depend on this issue. If we say dina de malchusa dina is limited to areas like taxation and general societal regulation, but it does not apply in the relationship of one person to another person, then indeed, dina de malchusa dina would not be legitimate. So there is a shaila in halakha one should ask their rav. Again, the issue is not, can you file for bankruptcy? You can file for bankruptcy, but the issue is, are you allowed to use the discharge that you get against a Jewish creditor, or are you mechuyav to at least make a separate arrangement with that creditor to pay him after bankruptcy? Under bankruptcy law, by the way, you're allowed to do that. You're allowed to make selective agreements. That's called a reaffirmation agreement. The question becomes whether halacha requires it. Again, I don't want to paskin for you, but it's certainly a serious issue that you have to consider. Be it as it may, if dina de malchusa dina is limited to those in yanim that are l'tayela samelech, since the government does not have any direct benefit in how your estate is going to be distributed, dina de malchusa dina would indeed not apply to the laws of Yerusha to validate a will. In fact, there's a tshuva sarashva that makes this point explicitly. And this is a very, very quoted tshuva. The tshuva of the Rashba dealt with the following scenario, a very interesting issue. The tshuva of the Rashba dealt with the problem of a man who married a woman, and the woman died within, and she brought in a substantial dowry, and the woman died within 6 months of the marriage. Now, under Din Torah, as long as there was nisuin, all of the property goes to the husband. Under the local law in effect in Spain, if a woman dies within 6 months, or within a year, in that case, of the marriage, her nidunya goes back to her father. Because after all, her father felt pretty cheated here. I mean, he gave all of his money, and now he goes to another guy 6 months later who marries somebody else. So this involved a din Torah where the father of the woman who died was seeking to recover the nidunya by arguing dina de malchusa dina will override the din of Yerusha Sabal, and the Rashba. And this is an important shuva, not only for the psak, but also for the lashon. The Rashba has a whole arichas, chas v'shalom, that we should apply dina de malchusa dina to these things. Otherwise, you might as well throw out chayshin, well, there was no toy there, you might as well throw out seder nezikin, throw out chazal, because we all have all of these laws of the umos ha'olam that will cover it. And therefore he says, vadai, 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 that there's no din of dina de malchusa dina by Yerusha, and the husband will be entitled to keep the entire thing. Interestingly enough, however, there is another tshuva from the Tashbats, or Tashbait, some pronounce it, of Shimon ben Semach, a little later than the Rashba, where he did apply dina de malchusa dina, but it was a very strange set of circumstances. This involved the Jewish community on the island of Majorca, one of the islands off the coast of Spain, in Madagascar, those areas. And apparently, the Jewish inhabitants had converted to Catholicism. So they were not a very religious community. And this involved a person who left instructions to his son that, you know, you inherit my estate, and upon your death, the property should go to a third party. This is called Gemara Mechasai Lech. My property goes to you for your life. V'acharecha, and afterwards it should go to Ploni. So you can do that normally, but the Gemara says the following. If the person that you're giving the property to is somebody who would yarshin from you anyway, in other words, you're giving it to your son, it's not shayach to limit the ownership that your son gets by a clause that says upon his death it should go to somebody else. In other words, Yerusha cannot be limited that way. However, under Dina de Machlus Adina, such a clause was valid. So the Tashbatz actually paskins that under Dina de Machlus Adina, the Acharecha clause would be recognized, notwithstanding the principle in the Gemara that someone who acquires by Yerusha cannot have his title divested. And the Tashbatz said, number one, we want to paskin at the first answer. He wants to paskin like the first answer of Maseches Gittin, that Dina Machlus Adina even helps Ben Adam Lechaveiro. Then he has another Svara, which is not Ungenum in Halacha at all. Since they converted, it's kind of, you know, they want to be Goyim, you know, they let them be, the laws by the Goyim, but again, the Maharik says that that's Yishtaka Hadavar V'lai Neymar, that Chas Hashem Yisrael Afal Pishachata Yisrael Heim, and even if they convert, we don't... They argue that Dina de Malchusa Dina does not apply for the validation of wills. So most Rishonim and Achrayim do not allow Dina de Malchusa Dina to validate a will. What is interesting, however, is that we do have some relatively modern poskim who actually do permit Dina de Malchusa Dina as at least one basis to validate a will. Among them are Rav Chaim Eiser. These are not poskim to take very lightly. And this is the Mashmos of Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Igros Moshe. It's a very difficult Igros Moshe, and it's really connected the main stream of Halacha. But you can certainly find two tremendous Gedolim of our century who were willing to utilize Dina de Malchusa Dina, particularly when it was a will that involved tzedakah. Although the logic should not be limited to tzedakah, but a will that involved tzedakah, they were willing to validate Dina de Malchusa Dina. There is also a special concern regarding tzedakah that some Achronim want to say, and that is, by tzedakah, by hekdesh and by tzedakah, we have a rule that says, Amiraso ligavoa, kimisiraso lehejit. In other words, if I declare something is hekdesh, it's like I gave it to hekdesh already. So some want to say that you say the same principle by tzedakah, and consequently, a verbal declaration that you want it to go to tzedakah is like it's already in tzedakah. Therefore, it's as if you gave it away in Mechayim, that's a special rule for tzedakah. And I should also mention a very intriguing svara of the Binyan Siyan. Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, he was a great, great German Rav. He was the Rebbe of Rav Shimshon Afal Hirsch. In the Binyan Siyan, the Aruch Haner, he writes the following. This is very intriguing. He ties in a secular will to mitzvah l'kayim divrei emes. Remember, I mentioned before that, according to Rabbeinu Tam, even if I leave an instruction that something should be given after my death, there's no mitzvah l'kayim divrei emes because I didn't create the escrow. The Binyan Siyan says the following svara. When you embody your instructions in a legally enforceable will, since the state is ready, able, and willing to enforce your instructions, making a will is equivalent to making them your escrow agents. And as a result, not Dina de Malchusa Dina, as a result, mitzvah l'kayem divrei hames can be triggered because the state becomes the shlish. However, keep in mind, this only answers the problem based on Rabbeinu Tam. It does not answer the problem when the Yorshim are Ketanim, because when they're Ketanim, even if you have the escrow, you still have that problem. Ketanim alav b'nei mitzvah. Rav Chaim Eiser was Meshabeach the Svara. He quotes the Binyan Siyan, and he says it's a good Svara. He felt that a legally enforceable will could be the getter of a shlish. You've made the government, as it were, a shlish who has the power to enforce that property. So Dina de Malchusa Dina is a possibility. However, and again, Rav Moshe was willing to go with it. However, many, many Paiskim, contemporary as well as earlier, find this problematical. It seems to be inconsistent with the Tshuvas HaRashba and the Ma'arik and other authorities. And therefore, many Gedolim advise that we should seek other Eitzos and not stam rely on a will, but try to create something halachically valid in a different way. So here I want to just articulate one of the most common ways in which one can create a halachically binding will without relying on the difficulty of Dina de Malchusa Dina. Method number one, which is the simplest way, but it's not going to work in many cases, is simply to give away your property when you're still alive. Obviously, if you give away your property when you're still alive, no particular problem. Of course, the problem is, you give away your property still alive, you don't have anything. That's not the best way to go. But the answer is, within halacha, there is a way that you can give away your property when you're still alive and have your cake and eat it too. And that is the transaction that is called, and the Mishnah itself recognizes this, Mehayom Uliachar Misa. Now, Mehayom Uliachar Misa literally means from today after my death. What does that mean? Is it today or after my death? What it means is that your makneh, you are transferring the guf, the physical ownership of the item, from this moment, but you retain for yourself the benefits, the income, the peiros, until your misa. And upon your misa, your right to peiros terminates, and the guf has already been transferred. Right? So, mehayom liyachamisa. Now, this would require a halachically valid kinyan, a legal document, a kinyan sutta. In other words, you'd have to talk to a rav in terms of how halachically do it. The truth of the matter is, the modern example in estate planning of mehayom uliachar misa is a very common estate planning tool, and that is the inter vivos trust. You establish a trust during your lifetime that says you will get all of the income during your lifetime, and upon your death, it'll revert to your son, your daughter, your wife, whatever it is. Irrevocable trust, that's right. That, according to halacha, would in fact be a kinyan that is mehayom uliachar misa. The only thing you have to be careful of is that you observe the halachic formalities in creating the kinyan. In other words, it wouldn't just be the documentation. There might be a kinyan that you have to do. Huh? A joint account. A joint account would be a valid way of having your wife get property. Well, a joint account is a right of survivorship. So, Well, let me think about that for a second. In other words, we have a joint account that says each of us. We are shutbim in our account today. That's right. So she's not inheriting. That's right. No, she owns all of it, because the reason is, in a joint account, each person can take everything out. That's very different, but a joint account isn't the way. A joint account is a type of shitfus. But we're talking about a joint account where either, you're talking about a joint account where either one can take 100% of the money with a single signature. No, joint property would only help for the half that she owes. It would, the other half would have to go through Yerusha, so that would not. You still have all of those problems. So Me'ayom Alachmi. Now there is one problem with Me'ayom. I didn't hear you. A trust is Me'ayom Alachmi. You have to describe that to me because I'm not sure. Yes, that's on Yom Alachamisa. In other words, any trust that which has a different beneficiary to be activated upon death is Me'ayom Alachamisa, as well as mitzvah l'kan divrei hameis. It actually picks up both aspects of it. In fact, even if there's not a halachically valid kinyan, it might constitute a mitzvah l'kan divrei hameis, because the trustee is a shalish who was given certain instructions. Now, there is, of course, a big problem with mehayom uliachar misa, and that is, we have a general rule in halacha, ein adam makne davor shelo baliyola, meaning, I could be makne to you anything that I own right now, but I can't be makne to you assets that I get later. Which means every time a new asset comes in and I put it into the trust, you'd have to do a new maisa kinyan of mehayom uliachar misa. It wouldn't be an automatic thing. And of course, we have a problem if a person dies and stuff came into the estates or into his property between the last maisa kinyan and the death, that stuff would not be subject to the haknah of mehayom uliachar misa, and therefore you have a problem. Similarly, the second common way of doing it raises the same issue. That is, sometimes people are makna, and instead of saying mehayom uliachar misa, they simply say, you should be kona my property. My wife should be kona 1/3 of my property 1 second before my death. You have a koach to do that, right? According to halacha, you can create kinyanim to be chal in the future. But once again, that can only cover something that you own now. In other words, I could be matne to you property I own now to take effect 30 years from now, but stuff that I acquire later cannot be covered by the kinyan now, because that's davar shelo baliyolam. So you keep on doing the kinyan over and over and over and over again, do it every 6 months, but the point is going to be that anything between the last kinyan and the death is going to be a davar shelo baliyolam. So these are common ways which can work in a lot of situations, but there could be leftover residual things which are going to be governed by the Seder Yerusha. The way the Ramah brings, it's interesting that the Ramah talks about a different Eitzah. Again, the only one the Gemara mentions beferish is Mehayom Uliachar Misa, and yet this is a problem of Davar Shelo Baliyolam. But the Ramah brings, again from Rishayim, and this is brought down in the Nachal HaShiva, which was a well-known sefer of business transactions and shtaris. This is called a shtar chatzi zocha. This was used in Eastern Europe as a mechanism to give daughters at least 50% of what the boys were getting, but if you use it for 100% as well, and it works in the following principle. The first thing you do is you write a will in terms of what your desires are. I want my wife to have this, I want my daughters to have this. In other words, this is your desires. I, under this, if the sons want to do it, the Seder, everything is fine. I, if I don't want to do it, it's Masna Mashkas Batira. Well, you write the following document. You create a fictional debt owing to your daughter. Now, the halacha is like this. The halacha is, a person is able to be mechayev themselves, a chov, towards other people. I could write a document saying, I owe you $1 million. That is a binding debt. Even if I didn't borrow any money from you, if the shtar says, I owe you $1 million, that is binding based on the principle of hoda'as baldin kameya eidim domi. The admission of a person, it cannot be controverted even by 100 witnesses in monetary matters. Now, when you create a chov through hoda'as baldin embodied in the shtar, a fictional chov, but it becomes a real halakhically enforceable obligation, a number of things happen. First of all, a chov that is created by a shtar in halacha creates a shibud on property, meaning to say, all of your property is mortgaged to that loan, to that chov. Now, midina de gemara, a milva b'shtar creates a shibud only on karka, only on real estate. Metalklim is not meshuba to a chayv, but there's a takanas haga'onim, which is brought down in halacha, that we paskin the bizman hazeh, the shibud of a chov even extends to metalklin, and that's why we say in the ksuva, when you're meshabed your property l'ksuva, you say, afilu miglima dial kasvoi, even from the shirt on my back. Remember, that's from the takanas haga'onim. The nisuch of a ksuva in the time of the Gemara would not have said, glima dial kasvoi. Now, when you create a lien on your property, the halacha is that when the yorshim inherit that property, the chov is enforceable against those assets. Now that doesn't mean the yorshim are personally liable. In other words, yorshim are not personally liable to pay the debts of their father. But the father's property is halachically meshubad for that chov. So let's take a very simple case first. I'll address how this works in more complicated cases. A man has a son and a daughter, and the man simply wants to ensure that his daughter will get half of the estate. Okay? So he writes a will that says, my daughter should get half. Well, that itself is not going to do it if the son doesn't want to share it. He then writes another document that says, I hereby acknowledge that I owe my daughter the sum of $1 million, but in the event my son agrees to transfer to my daughter, in accordance with the terms of my will, this conditional debt is null and void. In other words, so Mamela, the son has a choice. Does he have to obey the will? No, he doesn't. He is totally free to disobey the will and claim the entire assets of the estate. The only thing is, if he claims the entire asset of the estate and he's not maskim to the terms of the will, a chov has been activated, which is in an amount, well, again, $1 million, if the estate is not $1 million, the chov will only be, but the chov is enforceable up to the amount of the total estate. So the choice is, give your sister half or you lose everything. Because, in other words, you pick an amount in the chov that is equal to the whole value of the estate. So a normal, rational person is certainly going to agree to the chalukah of the will in order to avoid losing everything by enforcement of the chov. Now, again, one has to be very, very careful how this is written, because in creating a conditional obligation, you have to follow the rules of Tanai Kafel, meaning the condition should be stated both sides of it, and the Tanai Kaitim Lamaisa, meaning it has to be worded this way. Whenever you make a transaction on a condition, you have to first articulate the condition and then the action. So you say, you know, in the events that you don't agree to my will, my estate is hereby obligated for this chov. In the event you do agree to the terms of my will, then this obligation is null and void. Is that, yeah? Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, why couldn't the person do what? In other words, instead of using the chov as a mechanism, why don't you just put in the amounts directly as a chov? There's a shiloh. Okay. You could certainly do that on a specific dollar amount. You could simply make it easier, saying that there's a chov on my estate. I owe my daughter, $100,000. But there is a problem in creating a shibud for an indefinite amount. That's called a dover sheino mesuyim, and among some rishonim, you cannot create chovos, which are not for ascertainable fixed amounts. Now let me just explain why the shtar chatzi zachor does not have a problem of eino demakne dover shelo baliola. Because first of all, in terms of creating shibudim, when you create a shibud based on a chov, the shibud could be chal not only for the debt, for the property that you presently own, but it can even cover other property as well. Shibud is different than kinyan. In fact, look in the ksuva again. The ksuva says beferish, I am mishabed my property, dikanoi, that which I have acquired, udiasid anala mikna, and that which I will acquire. The Gemara says beferish, on a sheep.